everybody. That's what you want. A septuagenarian making wah wah noises into. Yeah, no, I can hear all of
Hello.
It.
Oh,
hey,
you can.
Guess what, folks? You are making history because this is a first. This is the first podcast ever to be recorded in my living knowledge at the Newport Comedy Room here at the Newport Bolo. That's right. Make a bit of noise. Because podcasting is all that. Have a look at these glasses, first of all right? So just get over the glasses. They have one handle. If we can just move on from the fact that my glasses are broke, that's fine. So, all right, I'm gonna do what we need for the recorded information, which is welcome to our podcast, Funny About Books, a series of live recorded interviews with comedians who author books, comics whose reach extends beyond the punchline, writers who take a sentence for a very long and winding walk. And in this episode, we interview two long-standing stand-ups. Wordsmiths in their own right, one man is so well regarded, he's honoured with both an Order of Australia medal and the mantle of living treasure.
Moi?
Sorry, pal.
Thank you.
Or is that just a euphemistic way of saying we can't believe you're still at it? 47 years in the business. Hello, Rod Quantock.
Thanks, Stella. Thanks, crowd.
And a man who arrived in Australia via Saigon, owning little more than a bad pair of flares, the self-confessed crappiest refugee, Hung Lee.
Yay! Ni hao.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.
Now, first of all, each of you are working comedians and published authors. So let's get to the heart of it, your namesakes. First of all, for 1 point, Rod, what is a Quantock?
It's a range of hills in England.
Oh, there you go. Excellent. So a Quantock is a range of hills. So that's very good. But Hung, yes. Your name has a whole other meaning, right?
Yeah, it's a bunch of valleys.
No.
Well, in Vietnamese it means Renaissance man, but in Chinese it means bastard son of redhead European.
That's right. So, now, both of you are comedians, both of you are authors, are writers. So, which came first, the writing or the comedy? And may I start, you know, age before beauty? Rod.
Oh, stand-up came first.
And how exactly? Because when you began stand-up, if I may say...
Well, when I began stand-up, it was a long time ago, and we didn't have computers. And
or paper?
Well, I was just going to say I was poor, so I didn't even have pen or paper, so much of my early writing is chiselled. it's weathered badly. No, I just started... I'd never written anything that I do on stage. And look, I feel like a bit of a sham being here, really. published one book of collected writings that I did for a newspaper.
And look, publishing a collected piece of work, is that just kind of like, did you choose them yourself? Did you actually go to that extent of choosing the pieces yourself, or did you let your editor do that?
Oh, no, I wouldn't let an editor do that. They mightn't have a sense of humour. I've noticed that over time. No, I chose them. They were the ones that I wanted to be remembered by, really, as I thrust this little baby of mine out into the publishing world where it wasn't advertised or in any way promoted, and it sank to the bottom of the library shelf. No, you can still get it through the library interchange system. I think it's got to come.
You might have to take a moment to explain to the audience what is a library.
They're old. Look at them. They know what a library is. Hands up anybody under 50. See, two.
Now, Hung, when you came along, there was a fairly substantial comedic habitat, which you document very vividly in your particular memoir, The Crappiest Refugee, but you took an alternate and different direction to Rod.
Yeah, when we came here, we didn't have any paper or pen or anything. So so I wrote my book on my phone. No, no. What are you saying?
Well,
when I was 30, I've written three books. I wrote one when I was 30, one when I was 40, and one when I was 50. Okay. So it takes 10 years for me to get enough stories.
Excellent. So, but the question was, did writing come first or comedy?
Comedy came first because I failed English in HSE.
I got a first class honour in English literature.
Oh.
The first person to fail the language, but to...
But you can read it well.
Yeah, I could read it exceptionally well.
Well, I couldn't even read it well. Yeah, I went out in high school, year 12, my short essays were only 2 inches long. Hey,
but you invented the tweet.
I invented tweeting. I don't even know. There wasn't even the
internet.
So what
were they? On my holidays, I escaped from Vietnam.
Yeah, what I did on my summer holidays, sailing away.
Not with a bang, but a whimper.
So, but I didn't know. Like, people used to write essays that went on for ages, and I only knew like how to write. This is the subject. You say something about it, and then you finish, and that's it.
Joke.
That's a joke. I didn't even know I was writing jokes. So I started writing jokes. And I went to Sydney when I was 20 to work the Sydney comedy areas, and this dude came up to me in the pub and goes, "Hey man, you should write a book." So I rang my agent, Michelle Wild. Rang my agent back, and she goes, "Don't write it, anyone. Give me a couple of days." So she rang up Penguin Books and she said, "Oh, I got you a meeting with Penguin Books." And I know, I just started comedy. And then I flew back to Melbourne and she had a meeting at Mario's with the Penguin Book lady. And Michelle said, "Look, just write one page of your stand up." It was all my Vietnam War stories. And the woman she was sitting there. She started reading my stuff. She started shaking. She goes, "I'll give you a contract on the strength of this alone." Going, "You beauty." So, so they gave me $10,000, and I blew it.
Yeah, of course you did.
I've never had $10,000 before. So I joined Circus Oz. I joined Circus Oz, and I blew the whole thing. And I didn't write anything. And then we had to have another meeting at Mario's, and she said, "Look, we want our money back. We haven't written anything." Going, "All right, I'll write it." She goes, "All right, well, we just have a meeting every week, and give me 10 pages every week." And that's what I did. We met at Mario's every week with 10 pages, and a book came out of it. Yeah.
Do you write your stand-up material?
Yeah, I just wrote stand-up material.
Okay. So you would have had a sort of base of stand-up material to put into the book?
Yeah, I had 10 minutes of material. Mm-hmm. So I was going around Sydney trying to plug 10 minutes of material. And I just wrote about my life because it was my first memoir. It was very small. And, about my life and all my playing the violin and busking and going to Edinburgh. And that was my life at that time. So, I just wrote it down and they liked it.
They should have.
Now, one of the dangers for comedians, though, is to, in the age of technology, is to let somebody either film you or record you or then upload you to YouTube, because what you just did and what you've just described to your publisher is that you pretty much put your livelihood on a couple of pages and handed it to her for the cost of a Mario's coffee, which is about $17.50. So it was probably a pretty good coffee. But that's a dilemma for comedians, isn't it?
No, it doesn't work that way. What it does is it sells 1,000 times more tickets to your shows, because the written word, reading it on your own, and they really are wonderful books, you must get them, is very different from sitting in an audience and watching a stand-up comedian. So they complement one another. If you remembered to bring some books tonight...
No, if I remembered, I didn't bring any.
Yeah, you could have sold some.
Yeah.
Now, in common, you two are polar opposites, but in common you have a pretty strong and fecund political turf from which you kind of mine a lot of your material, if I can say that. But is that how you see it? I mean, Rod, you kind of built a brand out of that, but Hung, your sort of career is very different, and yet most of the stuff that we saw tonight is really about sort of having a go at Australian values from, a political wellspring. So I'll give you some second to think about that.
You're not welcome here. No, I think Australia enjoy To see it from someone else's point of view, like, you know, an Asian guy's point of view, a refugee guy's. I just talk about my life and what is ever happening. But when, you know, thanks, Mum. And when I go overseas, when I go to Edinburgh and stuff to do my thing, and people overseas want to hear what's happening in Australia from an Asian slant, so to speak. You scallywag.
Yeah, oh, boom. Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, that's all I do. I just write stuff that happens to me, and I'm very lucky that funny stuff happens to me all the time. I don't even ask for it. It's just funny shit happens all the time, so I'm very lucky that way.
So, Rod, without politics as a mainstay, I mean, that's where you've rooted a lot of your comedic material, that's fair to say, yeah?
Well, yes, but I'll remind you, I never write it. So
what do you do?
I read a lot, and then I think a lot, and then I think how stupid and absurd everything is, and then I get up on stage and I tell people that. And it's basically that, really. It's not to be in any way arrogant, but for years and years and years, I've never worried about making things funny. What I've worried about is making them, in my lights, anyway, true, and surreptitiously to try and educate people.
Well, that's a good point, though, because what you do in your routines is assume people are relatively well-read. And what our concern is at the moment is that Australians don't care anymore.
Well, they've got too much to read. I mean, by the time you get through the New Idea, you're really struggling
for lunchtime.
Yeah, struggling for the rest of the week.
The doctor's ready for you.
Yes, that's right. How did you know that's where I got it?
So, do you reckon you can be taught to do comedy? Can you be mentored through this, or is it something you have to be born with the ability to do so? Born with. Mm. At the back, someone says born with. No, the man from Yarraville says born with.
It's really good if you're funny looking. Yeah, that's half the battle, isn't it?
No, you're a lucky bastard.
Yeah, thanks. Funny looking, a bit of charm.
You can't teach it to people who don't have the personality and the disposition to do it.
Right.
I know people who would be fantastic comedians, but they don't want to be. And I know people who are comedians who really should be culled.
Well, you don't think comedy has its own natural selection?
Well, it's not to be in any way arrogant, but I reckon I can tell within 3 or 4 minutes whether somebody's going to be a comedian or can be a comedian. After that, you can mentor them about, you know, how you deal with a gig, you know, what the requirements are, where you can go, you know, those sorts of things, introduce them to people. But you can't teach them how to do it.
So who are some current...
You can learn if you've got the basics, yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if you could just tell us who some current comedians are that you don't think are comedians.
When I started...
Thanks, that was... because I was just about to start alphabetically.
I had two people mentor me. I had John Heravam mentor me.
Oh, you were very lucky.
Yeah. The man was just too smart for his own good. And the man's brain is just so fast. I've never seen.
Do you want to tell some people here who he is in case they don't know?
He lived up the road, didn't he?
John Heravam. Well, how do you...
He was on ABC Radio. He had a regular thing on ABC Radio. And he... Just one comedy festival. He did a show in the city, and it was extraordinary. It was a really amazing thing that he did. But he was a mentor to people, and he got a lot of Melbourne comedians on radio. And he was particularly the problem he had is he lived in Yarraville, and you know it was a big hike to go and visit him. They were very good to go.
No, I went to his house once and The ABC was doing a documentary when I first started. He said, do you want to be in this documentary about up-and-coming comedians? So, yeah, all right. And so we went to John Heron's house to learn how to write comedy. And it was 9 o'clock in the morning. I turned up and he had a bowl of weed and two bottles of champagne. It's 9 o'clock in the morning. He popped the champagne and he said, well, let's go. He rolled joints and drank champagne. And he said, well, just tell me what you want to write. And I'm just telling all my stories about leaving on the boat and everything. And every time I said a story, he would smash his keyboard that, and there would be a punchline. I would tell a story and he'd go, and there'll be a punchline. It was amazing. He hit his keyboard so hard, there was no more letters. There was no more letters on his keyboard. This man with his brain was so fast. It was unbelievable. And he taught me and he he killed himself. Mm, he committed suicide. I think he...
That's a hell of a punchline hung to that story. Yeah. No, that's...
Trying to teach me how to do comedy, he killed himself.
Mm. Wow, so basically you were the... Okay. He gave you enough rope.
It's so sad. He was my teacher, you know. And Bruno Lucia took me on his wing as well. And, yeah, it was great. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you've got to be born with it, I think. You've got to be born with funny bones. You know, like the movie Funny Bones, like, you know, Jerry Lewis said, you've got to be born with funny bones, and I think you have to be to make it somewhere. And look how far we've come.
Yes, absolutely.
You've come all the way to Newport. Yeah, no, you're winning. You're winning. Now, how much of your work is observational and how much is experiential? Like, how do you do your research?
Oh, well, I have no experiences. I envy you, who seem to be a magnet for funny things happening. Nothing funny ever happens to me. Nothing ever. So, I get punctures and I think, gee, I could turn that into a routine, but it's a point, really. What I do is I read.
Do you get stuck in the tram tracks too, Rod?
Oh, I've done all sorts of things. No, twice you... John Fain's driven past me when I've had a flat battery and an exploded radiator.
Oh, you would have made his day because, yeah, God knows that man needs a lift occasionally.
So I just read things. I read... reportage and I read people writing about what's going on, interpretation. So that's what I do.
Do you have some go-tos?
Everybody's got to go to counterpunch.org. That's a really fantastic website out of America. I won't depress you with the other ones I look at.
But are there a couple of writers that you really rely on to kind of give you the
beat
on?
I rely on that webpage.
Yeah.
So I don't... Oh, look, I guess it's one of the things about reading things online. You just automatically skip over the author and you think nobody else in Australia is reading this. So
that's right. I just have to interrupt you for 1 second. There's a woman who is literally losing it in the audience. It could be unrelated to what you're saying. It could just be some private thing, but I feel that we should just throw some attention to her. No, it's sobered her up. I thought we'd get more out of it.
Share.
You can't do that on radio.
No.
No.
No, you can't. No.
But anyway, that's not even an audience here.
No.
They are fictitious people. And what about you, Hung? About, you know, do you...
When I first started, I read every book there was to read. I watched every Charlie Chaplin movie there ever was. Because in Vietnam, my father used to take me to Charlie Chaplin movies. And my mother used to take me to kung fu movies and I merged them together. we merged together. So, you know, what I do best is pretty much slapstick comedy. That's what I do best, like Mr. Bean stuff. And, yeah, from my father and my mother. But, to do stand-up comedy, that was the hardest thing I could ever do. That's why I found it, it wasn't in my... Yeah, talking to people and making... Yeah, it wasn't what I do best at all. So I just practice every day and watched every video there ever was. There was only one video, really.
It was Eddie Murphy, wasn't it?
It was Eddie Murphy. Yeah. That was it. There was only two videos ever. And they're still the two best stand-up videos ever.
Yeah.
Raw and, you know, delirious, right? So, yeah, they're the only two. I watch everybody and read everything. And maybe usually the Herald Sun is great.
Oh, it's fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah, they just narrow
just
it
laugh
down.
A minute.
Narrow it down, yeah, and for comedy.
And pick the typo. Now, what did both of your parents, each of your parents, I should say, think of your choice to become stand-up comedians?
Not a lot until I bought a house.
Aha.
That was it. You're right, you're on your way. Slapped me on my 35-year-old bum and off I went.
Oh, 35. You're very progressive these days. And Hung, I can't imagine your poor...
No, my mum doesn't know. She thinks I'm a cabin steward on a cruise ship. yeah, well, you know, I grew up playing the violin, so we were all classically trained in the house because, you know, we're Asian and we got 10 fingers and that's the law, play classical music. So, I started doing classical music. And when I started doing comedy was when I was 15. I played the violin, don't tell anyone, I played the violin, like, a little bit sharp, you know. It's not really in tune because... Yeah, and it wasn't so really bad, but it was just annoyingly sharp, and so you know, everyone was just, they hated me in orchestra and stuff. It's just, who the hell is that? And I was like, oh, it's me. I'm playing sharp again. So when I was 15, I took my violin. Me and my mate, we went out to Bourke Street, the Bourke Street Meyer Windows for Christmas. And we just started playing Christmas carols. And people just took so much money. This is in the 80s. We had so much money in the 80s because nobody ever seen an Asian play out of tune before. Hey? And they thought it was hilarious. And that's when I started doing the comedy. Yeah, play out of tune.
Jack Benny.
Do you all remember the Hey Hey Saturday episode in which Hung Lee's quartet that had five members won?
In 87. In 1987, we took the string quartet to Red Faces, and we won Red Faces. The judge was
Red.
Yep. Lou Richards.
and the president of Vietnam. No.
Nearly, the cowboy from the Village People.
Oh, wow.
Nearly.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Wow.
And yeah, we won. Yeah, we won. And
cultural maven.
It was five. Right. We won a trip for two to the Gold Coast. And we said, "Nah, man, we can't take this." And they said, "Well, what are we going to do?" And they said, "Oh, well, two you can fly, and three you can catch the coach, and there's no accommodation." We said, "Well, you can't take that either." So we said, "Look, how about you guys bring us back the next week as a paid guest on the Johnny Farnham going away special."
Oh, the first of many.
Johnny Farnham went away in 1987.
Yeah, and he still is.
And he still hasn't gone away yet.
No. And they've found life on Mars, and apparently his promoters have booked him a gig.
Yeah. So, yeah. There, yeah. Well, what was the question?
Oh, what was the question?
My parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, both my parents were artists, so they didn't care. They didn't want me to be a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They said, "Look, as long as you're playing music, you're still doing art." And my dad said, "Look, as long as you're not selling smack, you do whatever you want."
Yeah.
Because back then, you know, Vietnamese
people... That's how you started selling coke.
They just let me do whatever I wanted, really.
So
yeah, no, I was much the same.
And as you say, you know, the buying of the house, that is the great divider, isn't it?
But I was the first person in the family to go to university. So, you know, I had something to fall back on, which was an unfinished degree in architecture. So that was good. But I was on New Faces in 1960.
What?
What was it called? New Faces.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey Saturday.
No, but there was a show called New Faces with Bert Newton.
Oh, New Faces.
Yeah. And I was on that in, I don't know, 1970 or something. And I went out and did a routine that I did about a football coach. And everybody loved it. It was a good routine. It had been honed. It was class. But there was this girl on. There was this girl on from Gippsland who was a thalidomide baby. So she had, well, what they had, the really truncated arms. And she sang this song, "Stand By Your Man. Give him two arms to hold him." And the audience's tears are coming. So I came second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I should think so.
And yeah, I wonder why I'm bitter.
I was on New Faces.
Yeah?
Yeah, Bert Newton. I went on Bert Newton, New Faces, and Kamal was a judge. And Kamal and Ronnie Burns were the judge. But, Barry Crocker's daughter was on singing Cats, Memories from Cats, and, you know, I came second.
Well, if you've met Barry Crocker, you'd understand why. Now, how do we rate as a country for satire? Because
5 out of 10.
I ask that because, Rod, I would imagine you have some fond memories of the Fraser era, of which at the time everything was Fraser, Boo, Whitlam, Yay, although in his retirement, Malcolm Fraser has become quite the elder statesman and has proven himself to be a man who's very erudite and aware. Let me finish. But
I'm shifting uncomfortably.
Yeah, I can feel that. And Hung, you came to Australia pretty much on the back of a very strong Fraser incentive. And the Vietnamese community are in adoration of what Malcolm Fraser did for many, many refugees from Vietnam.
Yeah, Gough Whitlam didn't want us here, hey? No.
I think not prepared to comment.
Stealing Australian comedians' jobs.
Your job. So, yeah, I think the White Australia policy just finished. I think it's 1973.
It never finished, Hung. No, it never finished.
It's back. So we had to, we were languishing on refugee camps waiting for Gough Whitlam to get fired, really. Yeah.
It was you. Yeah. You were the cause. Yeah. You were the reason.
No, it wasn't a reason. But, we were waiting. And Malcolm Fraser took heaps of people. He took everybody in. So Vietnamese people love Malcolm Fraser. Mm.
And what do you reckon about that, Rod?
Well, I think that's an example of every silver lining having a cloud. you can't win in this country because the country's run by corporations, so you just can't win. They buy everything, they get everything they want, they own the media, they've destroyed the unions, they've privatised everything we own that we used to make profits from, and... You know, I think too often that we overlook the concept of assassination.
Okay.
Just seems to me the only practical solution that I can find.
That's fine.
Democracy's not
working. No, I'm very pleased that release form is wide-reaching and global. So, an issue that's come up with a lot of writers more recently is the idea of... where to draw the line between cultural appropriation and censorship. So we're getting, you know, we're living in the time of outrage culture.
Yes, I know. 10 tweets and you're gone.
Yep, that's right.
No, absolutely.
So where does that place the comedian / author these days?
Well, as a white Anglo-Scottish Saxon Cornwallian purebred Aryan... I don't need to appropriate other people's cultures.
But it's not a good time to be a white
culture.
Well, it's not a good time.
I'm a man too.
Yeah.
I mean, I just live in paradise. It's fantastic. Yeah. Me and Sam Newman. Oh, gee.
Yeah. I'm Rod's cabin steward.
But sometimes, look, I watch your routine. Hung, and sometimes I kind of get a little bit of envy that you can take that whole politically incorrect behaviour and just, you know, blow it out of a cannon.
Well, really?
Well, yeah, you can. You can.
Really? yeah.
Because you and I guess you put your stamp on the entire Asian community as well. You can kind of get away with talking about...
Well, I turn it into, like, my stories, hey. I turn it into this is what happened to me. So people can't really say, look, Hung, you're making stuff up. But I'm sure a lot of people have come up and said, look, you know, it's so great that you're taking the piss out of your own people. And I just go, mate, I take the piss out of you, but you don't even know it until 2:30
right.
in the morning,
yeah.
you know. Yeah. And I've already gone to bed, you know. Yeah. So that's my secret. Like, I make it sound like I'm taking the piss out of myself, but I'm really not. I'm taking the piss out of the audience, really. That's my secret.
Now, you've each written for stage, for screen, and also for non-fiction and memoir. And what do they each take from you? Because they're each a very different medium. What do you reckon, Rod? You say you don't write stand-up, so...
No, but I have written for television and I've written newspaper articles and magazine articles, so I have written things. It's just about what you write about, well, what you want to talk about, and then making it funny. And if you do it in words, that's one way. If you do it as stand-up, it's another way. So I can see there's a different discipline, and there's a lot of skills in writing that I just don't have. So if I write now, I really struggle because I haven't written anything for probably 20 years.
But you told a great story tonight about putting into a bottom drawer a lot of material that you didn't feel was appropriate to allow through to, say, commercial TV network, but then you finally sort of see it cropping up anyhow. So that's a particular kind of a...
Every performer has in some way a master, and if your master's commercial television, you may as well slit your wrists and call it a day. And the ABC is... Look, the ABC does some... It's done a lot for comedy over the years and continues to do that. But it's so under the watchful eye of the Liberal Party and the Murdoch press. I worked on a show called Backburner. And I wrote something that turned out to be quite controversial and somebody complained. And it took a year of the complaints department's time to investigate that claim. So next time I did something like that, I leaked it first into the public domain and then did it. So, no, there are always restrictions, and live performing is the least restricted. You just need to have something in common with people, and often, some gigs you do, you realise the only thing you've got in common with people is breathing. You really can't do 40 minutes on breathing. But as I get... it's been for a long time. People know me, and people who know me often don't like me, so they don't come. And some people do like me, and they come. And occasionally a stranger wanders into my view, and sometimes we bond and sometimes we don't. I'm quite sanguine.
Hung, have you found writing for stage very different to when you wrote your novels, or do they take something different from you? Or?
Oh, yeah. The things you write in your book are the things that don't get laughs on stage. So you just put it out in the book. Books and writing on stage are two different animals, really. Because, when you're on stage, you need the response straight away. But, when you're writing a book, you let people think about stuff, and, it doesn't have to be hilarious when you're writing books. And they told me this, Penguin Books told me this, hey, you don't have to write a joke every three lines. I go, well, that's how I learned how to do it. That's the only way I know how to do it. So it's good that they told me that. So, you can write a whole page with not 15 jokes in it. But when you go on stage, you have to have a joke every three lines. Yeah.
How did you feel after your works were published, though? Did you feel like you'd sort of let everybody in on some of your inner secrets?
Like having a heart transplant. You let everybody in. Like this book, the Crappiest Refugee, I finished it. And I hand it in, and they go, "Hung, man, you can't write a memoir, which is writing funny stories. You've got to put feelings into it." I go, "What?" He goes, "Hung, you have to put emotions." I go, "Really?" Because, when you're doing stand-up, there's not really any emotions involved. And so I had to go back and rewrote the whole book. We went through every story I wrote and wrote down how I felt about that situation. It was the hardest thing. It was the hardest thing, hey. But it happened. It came out and I felt really good about it and put emotions into stuff. My friends were just laughing at me, going, "Hung Lee, Hung, you're putting emotions into shit." So, yeah. I was crying on the computer. I'm like, what the hell's going on? Why is tears coming down on my laptop, So, it all comes out. So,
it paid off.
And it paid off.
Yeah,
I think it did.
Yeah, every book I sell, I get $1.50. Please buy one. And my mum can have that operation if I ever...
Well, look, in these last remaining minutes and in with the three people left listening to our podcast, you're both at an interesting stage of your career. So are you at legacy stage, like, or does it just keep rolling? Like, what is there a plan?
What a funny woman.
Is there a plan? Rod, what are you doing in the next 30 years?
Yeah. I know you can't shake your head on audio, but I'm shaking my head. No,
do you keep writing?
Oh, no, I don't write. I've got a research project at Melbourne University, but I've been doing it for 2.5 years and I'll never finish it.
Like every other PhD. Just before you finish, I just in my research, this is how it kind of came up for me on the internet. Rod Quantock, Research Associate, Research Unit in Public Cultures, University of Melbourne, Associate Melbourne Sustainability Society Institute, University of Melbourne, Patron of Tandem, Patron of RDoC Youth Foundation's Numeracy Program, The Axis of Stupidity, Scum Nation, Boredom Protection Policy and Part of My Carbon, they're the things you've written. You've also received several awards, plus your OAM, plus your Living Treasure. Oh, the Captain Snooze bit, we didn't talk about that. That's all right, we can move on from that.
Oh.
And then, Hung Lee, I researched you as well, but all I found was that you got a DUI in 2018, so I'm hoping you got your points back.
Yeah. And they put... I got done for drunk driving on the way to a gig, right?
So on the way to the gig?
On the way to a gig. Oh. So, and I put my picture in the paper. Yeah. And the Herald Sun put my picture in a paper with my kid's book. And my, I don't know, my mum's going, with a kid's book. I'm going, oh, my God.
Oh, they're bastards, aren't they?
They're bastards.
I emceed a march of cleaners, unionised cleaners. So Filipinos, just Middle Eastern people, most of them couldn't speak to one another. So they asked me to lead a march through the city and stop at these places and MC speeches and so on. And I did a lot for the unions, but this time they said, you can have $500. And I said, well, I'd be very pleased with that. That's good. So the Herald Sun rang me up and then questioned me all about it. And then I became in the Herald Sun a paid protester, a professional protester.
There you go.
And, and Andrew Bolt got stuck into me. That was good. That's a badge of honour.
Really? Yeah. I'm waiting.
Yeah.
I'm waiting.
Say something in favour of Muslims, you'll be right.
Oh, yeah. Right.
we'll all be right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for coming along to our first ever podcast here at Stellavision at the Newport Comedy Room. Will you please thank our guests, woo-hoo, authors Hung Lee, Rod Quantock,
thank you,
yourselves, Dave Stokes, our audio engineer, and we'll see you all again at another Stellavision show and hopefully for another Stellavision podcast. Yay. Thank you all so much for coming along.
Thank you, Stella. Thanks.